You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. You know, orchids are found everywhere on Earth except for Antarctica. On the show today, we'll talk about how to make them happy in your home. And our guest, Chuck Aker, a breeder of Phragmopedium orchids that produces new hybrids for sale to commercial growers as well as home hobbyists. His business is called Flasks by Chuck. So what questions do you have about orchids? What's your favorite orchid? Well, I always love to hear from you. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us to ideas@wpr.org. Chuck Aker, welcome back. Man, it's been a long time. I'm looking forward to hearing your voice.
Thanks, Larry. Yes, it has been a long time. I have to apologize for my hiatus there, but I'm back.
You've been around orchids all your life. Tell us about your family business.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, the history of our business is quite extensive. I have been very blessed to have grown up in the orchid business with my parents and my uncle and several other relatives involved. But, it actually is a very interesting history of how that started here in Madison. There was a prominent Madison area doctor, Dr. Clarence Schubert, and he had a small parcel of land on the north shore of Lake Mendota, just outside of Middleton there on Fox Bluff Lane. And he had a couple of greenhouses where he had an orchid collection going, and you got to grant that this is in the late 1930s. And his little collection of orchids and his parcel of property kind of got a little overwhelming for him. So he walked or drove up the road about a mile to my grandpa's farm where my father, Walter, and his brother, Paul, were living and farming. And he asked my grandpa, Henry Aker, if he could use these boys for some labor here and there. And Grandpa agreed, and so they'd go down there, you know, they'd walk or ride their bike down there and get involved with helping Dr. Schubert with his estate, with around the greenhouse, you know, various things to do and so on and so forth. Well, one thing led to another, and Dr. Schubert was, you know, pretty much already at that time worldwide renowned orchid person. I don't know how he got himself to be known that well at that time with the orchids, but he was importing plants from all over the world, and as his collection grew, he put up another greenhouse over there, and my dad pretty much became his right-hand man, as well as my Uncle Paul, and they just kept things going over there full steam, and after high school, my father and my uncle continued employment with him. They soon outgrew that property there on the north shore of Lake Mendota, and Dr. Schubert came to my grandfather once again and asked if he could buy a parcel of land, and grandfather obliged, sold him a parcel of land of 20 acres there on Highway Q, and they started erecting the greenhouse complex in 1948 on that facility.
Wow.
Every year they would add another one, and it took till 1959 where we finally had the 40,000 square foot glass greenhouse finished, and you know they were putting plants in each greenhouse, you know, every year as they finished it. Dr. Schubert's collection was just exploding. He was a very avid person in breeding orchids already at that time, and you know, being a doctor, he had access to all the fancy things that you need to, you know, do autoclaving and things for producing orchids,
sure,
which is all done in sterile technique. So, yeah, by 1959, they had themselves a rockin' orchid business going there, and it was mainly for the production of orchids for the cut flower market, for the wholesale cut flower market. So they were raising all these Cattleyas and Cymbidiums and Phalaenopsis, cutting the flowers, shipping them off to the wholesale houses around the Midwest, and then they would in turn go from there to various florists, and the florists would then use them for, you know, the corsages. You know, back in those days, everybody wore, you know, corsages to proms and Easter and Mother's Day, and orchid corsages were everywhere. So the cut flower business was really big, and that kept going for quite a long time. But in 1963, tragedy struck, and Dr. Schubert passed away, and it was kind of unexpected. He They put the estate up for sale. My mom and dad, Walter and Magdalene, purchased the estate from the Schubert family and turned it into Orchids by the Acres at that time. So in 1963 was basically the inception of the Orchids by the Acres name. And my dad and my uncle and my mom, another longtime employee that was with Dr. Schubert, Jim Frederick, they all just kept that place going. I had my brother working in there for a while, various cousins now and then. As I grew up, born in 1959, right at the time they finished building the whole greenhouse range, I started in as a very young boy. Simple tasks, you know, I remember one of the first things I was delegated to do was sit at the bathroom sink in a very cold bathroom with cold water as a very young boy and fill these little glass tubes with water for the cut flower market. And we'd do hundreds and hundreds of these glass tubes. And, oh, I got to tell you, I hated it. But it was part of the thing you had to do when your parents ask you. So, yeah, my first recollections of working in the greenhouse were not great. But
there you go.
Yeah, so we just kept that going and, you know, just, that's where it kind of started. So a lot of history from there on yet as well.
And your business, you've got a business of your own. It's called Flasks by Chuck. And somebody's going to say, well, what the heck do flasks have to do with orchids?
Yeah, that's a question we commonly have gotten over the years, too. Well, orchid is an interesting seed. It's not like when you go put a bean or a tomato seed in the ground and you got a plant, you know. The orchid seed is what's called an unprotected embryo, so it does not have the endosperm coating around the embryo, and the endosperm coating around most seeds is basically its food source for the seed to germinate once it hits, you know, whatever substrate it's going to grow on. So with the orchid not having that, it needs a specialized situation to be germinated. When it's done, you know, in captivity here artificially, we call it flasking. And what that basically is a fairly complicated laboratory process where in sterile technique, autoclaved growing media called agar, which has certain components to it, the seed is sprinkled and dispersed into this sterile agar after it's been autoclaved and sealed up and kept, you know, clean like a sterile room, and that's how orchid seed will germinate. From there on, it's a slow process. It takes anywhere from, you know, 6 months to 18 months for some orchid seed to actually germinate, and then from that point, it takes, you know, another year or more in some cases for the seedlings to develop fully while still in the flask, to be large enough and healthy enough to be taken out and actually planted in the outside environment, you know, in your greenhouse in a pot or called a community pot at that time. So, yeah, it's a very, very slow process generally from germination to a flowering sized or flowering capable orchid can be as little as, you know, 24 months all the way up to 10 or 12 years, depending upon the species or the variety. So it's a very slow process. And the flasking is a real essential part of that, because without that technique that was developed back in the, I think it was back in the 30s already, and, you know, it's been very much perfected nowadays, where most of the laboratories have, you know, certain medias that work really well for certain genera of orchids. So it's really gotten quite scientific.
Yeah, Craig in Portage actually has a question about growing from seeds, I believe. Let's go there. Craig, hi, thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. Can you hear me all right?
Yes, we can.
Yes. Okay. Well, I was just listening to your discussion, and it sounds complicated. I was calling because my wife has been trying to grow orchids for about 2 years, and she's doing from tiny, tiny little seeds. She has tried starting them outside. She has tried starting them inside. She has tried different soils, different amounts of water. And if she ever does get them to grow, they get about an inch tall, and then they croak.
Well, that is not fun when that happens. Indeed. May I ask you what type of orchid she's attempting with there?
You can ask. I have no clue. She had bought different seeds from different places because, you know, when she got some, she's like, well, I don't know if the seeds are good. Maybe I'll order from this place or whatever. So I don't have all the answers you're going to want.
Yeah. Well, let me just give you a little info there. You know, if she's dealing with some of the native orchid varieties that are, you know, native to North America, let's say some of the Cypripediums or Calopogon, or, you know, there's 40-some naturally occurring orchids here in Wisconsin, believe it or not. But, you know, if she's dealing with those, you know, that's one thing. If she's dealing with the tropical orchids and she's obtaining seed from sources, I don't even know anybody that's actually selling seed of tropical orchid varieties, and if they are, they really shouldn't be doing it. But that, you know, that requires that specialized germination technique of the in vitro, what we call in vitro solution in the flask with the sterile technique. Whereas most of the native orchids, they have a tendency to germinate, you know, in different situations under, you know, let's say just some regular vermiculite or some kind of soilless mix that you put it in. Some need to be vernalized, which would be like chilled or near frozen to germinate, and so on and so forth. So without knowing exactly what type of orchid she's attempting with there, or what, you know, or origin they're you know, coming from, what genera and so on they would be, it'd be very difficult for me to offer any assistance. And, you know, have her send me some information. If she, you know, gets my email off of my website, which is flasksbychuckacre.com, or you can just Google my name, Chuck Acre Orchids, comes up pretty good. I'm out there all over the internet as far as that goes, and I'd be happy to help her a little bit more.
And Chuck's last name is A-C-K-E-R.
But correct. Thank you, Larry.
To get that. So there you go, Craig. There's lots to consider if you're trying to grow them from seeds, that's for sure. Probably easier just to go buy one or deal with Chuck. And I'm going to ask him about his business, Flask by Chuck, as well. But just a reminder, you're listening to Garden Talk, of course, and our engineer always does a great job, is Tyler Ditter. Jill Nadeau is our producer, doing her great work as well. And I'm here with Larry Mueller, and you're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network and Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller. Chuck Acre, our guest today. Chuck has a business of his own relating to orchids. And it's great to have him with us. His business, by the way, is Flasks by Chuck. So questions for him, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us to ideas@wpr.org. Just before we go back to the phones, the whole business about flasks, relating to your business, Chuck, how do you you sell the flasks of orchids?
Yes, I do, and that's exclusively what I do. Now that I'm not affiliated with, you know, my family's former business at all, I had been, you know, producing Phragmopediums for, you know, our commercial orchid business back when we were still open and in business, and it's been a great hobby of mine, which I have continued to do, you know, after the semi-retirement of my career of growing orchids. It's very exciting to be able to raise the Phragmopedium orchid, because I think, you know, there's probably less than a handful of us in the country, much less around the world, that are actually hybridizing and breeding with this particular genera of orchid. So there's quite a niche for it. I sell to, you know, large commercial growers in Hawaii that, you know, can buy hundreds of flasks at a time, to the small hobby grower that wants to try to, you know, try their hand for the first time at growing seedlings from flask, which is, you know, a challenge, but yet it's very rewarding when you do succeed. So it's a very, very diverse customer base. Pretty much known around the world for my work. Again, there's not a lot of people that do it, so I've been very fortunate to, you know, have a collection of these Phragmopedium plants that I use for breeding, and I call them my stud plants. I've amassed over the years, and yeah,
pretty cool.
Quite exciting. Yes.
Well, let's take a call. Angela in River Falls, we'll go to you. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Bloom lasted quite a long time, and it was really pretty, but then it died.
Oh, you're breaking up, Angela. She's got a plant that's not reblooming, and I'm not sure what orchid she had. I didn't hear that.
Yeah, I didn't either. And, of course, that's very pertinent when we're trying to give cultural advice due to the fact that the orchid is, I think it is the world's largest flowering plant family.
Well, let's see. Angela, are you there?
I happen to be driving right now, so I can't look at the pot. It looked like it came from a florist.
What kind is it?
I don't know.
What does it look like?
It was a white flower with kind of pink, probably like a mid-size
flower. Okay, that there's a lot of white ones out there too.
Yeah, she just described, you know, several thousand different. I would assume it's more than likely the Phalaenopsis.
That's what I was thinking too.
You know, they are the most popular and most successfully grown orchid as a houseplant, and typically when one has one that does not want to reflower, it's one of two issues. They either do not get enough light in our home, where they do like a lot of light. It is really important in our northern latitude here in Wisconsin or the upper Midwest to provide as much light to these plants as you possibly can while they're indoors. Some varieties even like to grow outdoors, but Phalaenopsis is typically an indoor orchid. And sometimes you've got to move the plant around from window to window, from season to season, because our sun, our light source is very transient. And you can tell right now our south windows are very strong with light right now, with the sun being low in the horizon, which is great. And then as that sun gets higher and higher in the sky, that south window gets increasingly lower light, and you've got to move around, go to an east or a west, or even sometimes in the middle of the summer, your north window offers you the best light in some cases. But light is very important. I recommend to, you know, keep it as close to the window as you can without damaging the leaves. We have a lot of new houses with low-E glass, which cuts down a lot of the harmful rays of light. You can put your orchids or your plants in general so much closer to the window with that kind of glass. The other thing is I recommend taking your screens off during the winter. Screens are basically offering some percentage of shade. That's what we used in the greenhouse to actually produce shading for our orchids, is we put this mesh screen up over the top of the plants. And so that really does help, too. It offers, you know, that as much light as you can possibly get without damaging the leaves from, you know, the sunburn, the heat from the sun. And the other thing is a lot of people don't recognize that even though the orchid is a tropical plant, and they think in their mind that it likes it this warm and lush and humid environment. That is somewhat true, but the orchid also responds to the differential of day to night temperatures. So it likes to be in the warm day and then the cooler night. So don't be afraid to have it in a room that, you know, possibly is not used, where you can close the door or whatever at night and the heat's going to drop. The cooler night temperatures often are what helps initiate the bloom spikes on the Phalaenopsis, and that usually happens in the fall of the year naturally as our climate cools from the summer's heat. But in some cases, we start heating our houses earlier and earlier all the time, so they don't really get that differential or that transition of seasonal temperature. So it's important to recognize that as well. And those are really the two things, and minor things are fertilizers and repotting it correctly at the right intervals and, you know, having a healthy plant to start with. But between the light and the temperature, those are really the two ingredients.
There you go, Angela. Thank you so much for calling. Let's go to Wayne in Madison. Wayne, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. We have I don't know what kind of orchid it is that was given to us, and it has sent out stems and bloomed a few times. Now, one of the stems has what appears to be a young orchid on it with a small root, and I'm wondering, what can we do with that? Can that be planted and start a new orchid, or what happens?
Yes, yes, yes. What you have there is more than likely the Phalaenopsis again, and they have a propensity to produce a small plantlet up on the node of the existing flower stem or an older flower stem that had already expired. And they're commonly called the kikis, and kiki is just the term the Hawaiians use for baby. So in the orchid world, those are kikis. And once that plant actually has developed its own root system, whether it's one or two, three roots an inch or so long, it can be severed from that stem and planted in its own individual pot. Use a small pot. Orchids like to be crowded with their root system, so especially when you're starting out with a young plant like that. Typically, most of the kikis will go into a 3-inch pot or 3.5-inch pot at the most, unless you've got one that's really been left on the mother plant a very long time and has gotten quite large with roots hanging down, 4 or 5 inches. But yes, that is a very common thing with Phalaenopsis, and that little kiki, that little plant's going to be a carbon copy or a clone of the mother plant, so it's going to be exactly the same flower color and flower stature and everything that the mother plant was. So that's one way that they propagate. It's not a way that we use in, production form. Obviously, we do more seed producing and tissue culture producing than that, but there are types of Phalaenopsis orchids that have a higher propensity to do that than others too. So you might have yours actually do that again, your mother plant, your older one, do that again as it goes on in the years. So yeah, that's great.
Yeah, that's really cool, Wayne. And then just use a medium, an orchid medium of some sort.
The orchid potting mediums are quite diverse too, especially for Phalaenopsis. We see a lot of Phalaenopsis growing now in the long-fibered New Zealand sphagnum moss. It also comes from Chile. It's been very successful as of late for raising the Phalaenopsis. It's obtainable, it's somewhat renewable. There's also bark-based mixes that you can use, commercial things you can buy from any garden center, orchid bark mixes. Sometimes you have to be a little careful. There's some brands out there that I don't know the name of right offhand, but there's really little water retentive material in some of these orchid bark mixes that you can buy, so a lot of the plants tend to dehydrate. If you end up with buying one of those, you can just throw a handful of peat moss or garden moss in there just to give it something, to hold some moisture. But the biggest thing with that is again, don't put them in too big of a pot. The orchid loves to have their roots crowded so they can dry out fairly quickly between their watering cycles. So that's really what helps keep a healthy root system. If they stay wet too long, the roots they rot because they are already 90% water.
Wayne, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. I hope that helped. By the way, you can join in, too. We have some open lines. Get you on pretty quickly. The number is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or you can email us, the email address, ideas@WPR.org. Let's take a call from Kel in Sugar Camp. Kel, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was wondering if you have ever experimented with meristem flasking. Maybe 35 years ago, I was working in New Haven, and a bunch of us were interested in orchids. We used to go to this famous greenhouse in Easton, Connecticut, that dealt with mostly miniature. They were trying to save miniature orchids from extinction. Mm-hmm. And they did a lot of meristem culture to propagate, but they also crossed species that wouldn't cross normally, and they got incredible flowers out of it with meristem. I was wondering if you've ever played with meristem.
Well, absolutely. When we were in business, many, many of our orchids were produced from the tissue culture of the, you know, meristematic tissue being taken and propagated from that. One of the, probably one of the most important genera of orchids that we had been doing that with was the Cymbidium orchid, and they were very, very easily cloned by taking the meristematic tissue. It was probably one of the most prolific genera of orchids, and you can see that, you know, out in the West Coast where Cymbidiums are still very popular. They grow them outside all year long, like we do shrubbery around here. But yeah, we had done a lot of cloning, what we call, you know, the meristemming or cloning. When we would also make crosses, and then we would select certain seedlings once they would bloom from those crosses that were deemed, you know, really special or different, if we came up with something very unique, those plants would go to the lab and get tissue cultured. So yeah, that was a huge, huge thing for our business. I personally have only done it a few times with a friend of mine in a lab that he was here in Madison, back in the late 80s when we were playing around at one of the university labs that he was working in, and he invited me up, and so I had my hands, you know, into that for a little bit. I'm not real specialized at it by any means, but I know about it, and we did a lot of it for our own business and our own orchid production. So it's one way to get many, 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 up to thousands if you wanted, plants of the same exact copy of what the parent plant is. So, again, when we hit on something really, really exciting and diverse, unique, we would clone 300-400 plants of that, and it was just wonderful to see a whole bunch of the same thing blooming like that. But then again, the diversity you get from hybridizing and growing from seed is also very exciting as well. So, yeah, great, great fun. But I think you're probably referring to J&L Orchids out in Connecticut. I think that was the company that you might have been. They were very big in the miniatures. And
is that right? Was it J&L, Cal?
Yes, it was.
Yeah.
Are they still in business?
I don't think so. I'm pretty sure the girls sold. There was three ladies running that, and they used to come to our show here in Madison, Orchid Quest, which started already back in 86 or 87, I think it was the first year. They have wonderful, wonderful group of ladies, and they would bring just all these beautiful miniatures that were mounted on, you know, pieces of cork slabs and pieces of hickory bark or something. You know, they were mounted, so they were growing just like they would be, you know, in their native as an epiphyte. And then, of course, they had their plants in the pots, you know, their terrestrial varieties or their semi-epiphytic varieties. And they would just have hundreds and hundreds of plants on their sales table that came in a little box, you know, and here we had all this big stuff that we came with four van loads with. But, yeah, when they came, they were always very popular at our show, and we miss them because that's a huge niche. There's unfortunately been so many commercial orchid growers, you know, closing their doors in the past decade, and, you know, ours being one of them.
Yeah. Cal, it's been great talking with you. Thank you so much for calling. We'll give Kirk a chance in Boston next. Kirk, hi.
Hi. Thank you very much. I am an opportunistic mushroom cultivator, and so I'm familiar with the technology. Could you elucidate the culture recipes for seed and for cloning?
Well, I really don't have that at my disposal right now, but the basic, I know the lab that works for me is in Michigan, and a lot of that material is kind of proprietary, but there is a basic germinating media which you can get from Sigma, and it's just their basic orchid media, I think they call it, or whatever. You get on their website and dig around. There's nothing fancy about most of it, but when the labs really start to specialize and want to tweak something, you know, they will be adding different amounts of banana powder or potato or less charcoal, more charcoal, you know, all kinds of different things in there to tweak it a little bit to give that plant the sugars it wants. So, yeah, that's really, really specialized stuff. But to get you started, I think if you went to the Sigma website, you'd be able to find your orchid media and get something going pretty easy.
There you go, Kirk. Thank you. Nancy in Grafton. Hi, what's on your mind?
Hi. My neighbor across the street, people give her orchids. But then she gets, they get kind of get dry back and that, she gives them to me. Well, I put them in my south window here, and they come back, and they look so pretty. And when it's really nice outside, and one of the orchids is blooming real nice, I'll take it over to her house so she can take a look at it and see what it looks like. But the right. thing is, I'm wondering, I don't put any ice cubes. She told me ice cubes, I just put water in them to dry and moisten them. But there's a street light right across from my house, and that's on all night long. And that's that orchid sees some light during the day and all night long. But, boy, that thing just keeps blossoming and blossoming, and it lasts forever. And so it's got a lot of new bulbs on it, or buds on it, I should say.
Yeah.
And flowers, oh, wow.
So, yeah. You got a great window there. Again, the south-facing window is typically good. Phalaenopsis orchids are really good houseplants. They don't require a lot of fussing around, and you find that right spot for them, and they just flourish. I mean, granted, not everybody has that in their homes. You know, we've got live in the trees or whatever. You don't have the good light and so on, but, you know, you do. And as far as that street light being on, it's kind of funny you would mention that, because that does have an effect on some types of orchids, Phalaenopsis not being one of them. But there's certain types of Cattleya hybrids that are very sensitive to the day length. And what we would do actually in our cut flower production days is we would trick them to bloom at a different time of the year simply by putting a 40-watt incandescent light bulb above them for several hours after nightfall to extend the day length and make them think it was still summer. And then we would turn that light off after 14 or 16 weeks of that, and then they would bloom in 2 or 3 months after that. So that's called being photoperiodic or photosensitive. And, you know, Phalaenopsis is definitely not one of them, so you certainly don't have to worry about that. They probably actually benefit from it, to be honest with you. Obviously, in her case, their plants are going pretty good.
Great. Nancy, thanks a lot. Appreciate your call. You can trade in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234, and we'll get you on pretty quickly. Let's go to Crystal in Madison next. Hi, Crystal.
Well, hello there. I am a notorious plant killer, and orchids are the first thing in my home that I've been able to keep alive, which just is insane, I feel like. But I have about 4 different orchids. I repotted them once into 5.5-inch pots, and now they have these roots that are probably about, I'm measuring right now, about 8.5 inches long, shooting up, you know, from the top. I just ordered new pots, 7.5 inches, and I'm wondering, will I have to continue repotting, and when does it stop?
Well, you have a good environment there, apparently, for humidity. The air roots that are coming out on your plants there are apparently very happy, and that's indicative, you know, that your humidity is more than adequate. It is very common for many of the orchids to have a fairly active air root system, because most of the orchids that we are cultivating, you know, commercially for sale are epiphytes, which means they grow on the trees or they grow on other plants. So their roots are actually happier, you know, out of the mix than sometimes in the mix. But nevertheless, you have to have some mix to anchor the plant, you know, to grow it in and have it in a pot where you can, you know, carry it around and have it sitting upright and so on and so forth. But I wouldn't be too concerned with the air roots right now. I mean, generally speaking, at the time of repotting, you try to tuck as many of those air roots into the pot and cover them with the media. One thing I can suggest is try moisten those roots several hours before you try to manipulate them, because if you moisten them, they'll become a little softer and a little more flexible and pliable, whereas you won't have the propensity to break them as much as they are when they're dry. But try to get as many as you can back into the pot, and they're going to come crawling back out again. You know, that sounds like, again, your culture there, whatever your humidity and the rest of your culture is very conducive for that to be happening with your orchids. So I got to commend you with that. And being a plant killer in general, and you're doing so well with orchids. It's interesting you'd say that. Orchids sometimes, you know, they thrive more on neglect or more on, you know, not the pampering type of thing. So we found that with a lot of our customers, it's like, you know what, just water it and forget about it. Don't fuss over it or you're going to kill it. Maybe that's your case. I don't know, but congratulations either way. That's really
that's right.
Great. When you repot, sometimes you have to go up a size, yes. Sometimes you can cut off some of the dead roots and, you know, get it back into the same pot with the fresh media. So, you know, either way, I can stress, do not overpot, meaning don't put your orchid in too big of a pot because they do languish. They like to be snug like that. It's better to repot them more often than to have them sitting in there languishing and possibly start root rotting because they stay wet too long or something of the sort.
Yeah. Crystal, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Terry from Amherst emailed. She has 16 orchids that have survived 7 to 12 years. She'd like to know what's the right type of bark to use for orchids. Can she use any type of bark from her own property for a potting orchid? Do they need to be sterilized, the bark, before using it? And at what temperature and how long if you're going to sterilize?
You know, I have known people to use some bark from their trees around, you know. I wouldn't recommend it. It's just a lot of fussing around with, you know, you got to do the sterilizing, what temperature, what duration. Yeah, those are good questions. Typically, it's 180 degrees for 10 minutes. But I would recommend highly to use the bark that comes from New Zealand called Orchiata. And we started using it in 2012. It is an amazing bark. It's a renewable pine source. And, you know, we used to use the Douglas fir bark from the West Coast, and that has gotten increasingly more difficult to get. And it does not have the same integrity as the Orchiata bark does. When we started using Orchiata bark, I mean, I'm a pretty hard sell. It takes a lot to impress me. And I planted some languishing orchid seedlings into that the first year that we tried it, and I could not believe within just weeks new roots were coming out. The plants perked up, and I was amazed, and we started using it exclusively. We discontinued the Douglas fir-type bark mix altogether. My source for Orchiata is in Madison is typically Paradigm Gardens on South Stoughton Road. They have a little hobby bag you can buy or a big bag. In her case, she'd probably want the larger bag, having that many plants. You can use it straight out of the bag. You don't have to mix it with any perlite or vermiculite or peat moss or anything. It has properties of water retention, yet it's a hard bark where you get longevity out of it, 2, 3, 4 years in some cases, if your plant, you know, is going to be able to stay in that pot that long and not overgrow it. It is really, really one of the best barks right now. You can also buy it online, Amazon, different sources, different greenhouse supply companies carry it. But again, if you're in Madison at all, Paradigm Gardens is the place to go for it. But absolutely the best orchid potting bark, in my opinion, by far.
And thank you very much for that question. Chuck Aker, our guest today, his business is Flasks by Chuck. And the address, go to flaskbychuck.com. Breeder of Phragmopedium orchids, produces new hybrids for you and for me and for large businesses as well. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Chuck Aker, breeder of Phragmopedium orchids and produces new hybrids. And, of course, we're talking all about everything you want to know about orchids, and I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or email us to ideas@wpr.org. Let's take another call. Eric in Sussex. We'll go to you now. Hi, Eric. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. I have a sick Datura. I think it's Datura Impact Red. It's five stalks in the same pot they are actually daughters from an original plant. And it was only one that got transplanted, and it was doing great. It's been in there for 3-4 years or so, but now it's dropping leaves. It's gradually managed to drop all its leaves, and in one last-ditch attempt at staying alive, it's sending out a flower stalk. I wonder if you have any suggestions about what I might do to try to revive this.
Well, Datura is definitely not an orchid. I do know a bit about Daturas. I've grown them myself, you know, both in the greenhouse and, you know, outside for the summer. And, yeah, probably maybe take a look at it and make sure it doesn't have spider mite. They have a real propensity to get spider mite when they're indoors. So check the undersides of those leaves and make sure that you don't have a mite infestation, something like that going on. Other than that, yeah, I'm not an expert at it, so that's a little bit out of my field. But I would check the mites for sure. I know the mites love those plants.
There you go, Eric. Thank you for calling.
All right.
Oh, man. Debbie in Beaver Dam, it's your turn.
Hi, Larry. How you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
I was just going to tell you, I've got about 10 orchids, and they're all different kinds, but the one that I really like, it's called a Phaeus microburst, and it's called Wild Thing Terrestrial Orchid. And it's got, I don't know how many stalks coming up, but it's going crazy.
Yes. The Phaeus is a wonderful, wonderful houseplant. You don't really see them around that much. When we have orchid shows here in the Midwest, like in Madison, the Orchid Quest, you know, people would be bringing those. This is their bloom season right now. They would sell. We had them at our greenhouse. Oh, my gosh, yes, they're gorgeous. The flowers are just brilliant. The foliage is attractive. They kind of look like a spathiphyllum or a peace lily when they're in their growing state, so they have a really attractive leaf structure to them when they're not in bloom, whereas most orchids aren't much to look at when they're not in bloom. Easy to grow. It's a terrestrial and it's native. Microburst is a hybrid produced, but they're just really, really fun plants to grow. Back in the Victorian days, in these old Victorian houses in England, they had the Phaeus species called Tankervilliers. Very, very popular plant in that time period. They loved the big, tall windows and the cooler, airy rooms, the brightness. They would grow these. You'd see pictures in the books that these things would be in these huge 16 or 20-inch urns, and they would have 30, 40, 50 flower spikes on them, just magnificent specimens that, you know, they were just so easy to grow. And basically the microburst is, you know, descended, hybridized, you know, from that particular species through the generations, and, you know, bringing in colors like reds and bright oranges, and just really, really great plant. I'm so glad that she brought that up. I wish they were a little bit more popular in the mainstream. You know, occasionally you see some of this odd stuff at the big boxes, but with so very few commercial orchid growers anymore, you know, it's very difficult to find this material. You can get it online. You know, I think the next closest orchid grower commercially to us here in Madison now is Orchids by Hauserman down in Elmhurst, Illinois, and they have a wonderful selection of material, generally speaking. And I'm sure they would have the Phaeuses and the, you know, that type of orchid in stock.
That's great, Debbie. Thank you so much. You know, you mentioned there that so many of the growers have gone out of business, and yet it just seems to me, you know, in my own little circle here, that there seem to be more orchids, or they're a lot more available than they used to be.
That is very true, and that comes in part because of the importation. Back in the 90s, our government started to allow the importation of orchid plants in pot. They typically were coming in bare root from other companies, other countries. Once we started receiving orchids in pot like that, that's when things really exploded. Just about anybody could order these orchid plants that are pre-finished, possibly even in spike or in bud in some cases, but typically in spike, which means they're going to bloom, you know, shortly, within a month or so. You receive these plants by just, you know, cases and cases of them. Throw them on a bench or put them in your garage under a grow light, and anybody can start marketing orchids. And that's really one of the things that put the nail in the coffin for a lot of the commercial growers in our country, unfortunately, was the influx of those plants being imported. They became very inexpensive in compared to what it would cost us to raise that same plant here in the United States. Most of the big commercial growers over in Taiwan and Thailand and China and so on, they are all subsidized by their government. So these plants are coming in for, a couple dollars in some cases, and somebody puts them on the bench for a month or so and finishes them off and gets them out to the market. They're very affordable. I can go to any grocery store and pick up a Phalaenopsis orchid for under $20 now, and it costs us way more than that to grow one from seed to flowering size. So, I mean, that's one of the things, and it's good and bad, yes. It gave a lot of people a chance to get their first orchid, which is great, and then they would come out by us and, you know, possibly want help with repotting or pick up another orchid while they were there and so on. But, it was really one of the things that started the demise of a lot of us commercial growers with the importation, was we just couldn't compete with that anymore.
No. Robin emailed to ask if you could give basic care instructions for Phalaenopsis orchids, including the best way to water. Also, should you cut off the spent flower stalks?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Yeah, the best way to water, if it's growing in a bark-based mix, is take it to the sink and water it thoroughly. If your water is coming out of the tap, it's softened. You don't want to use softened water. Just find a tap in your house that's not running through the water softener. If your water is coming out of the tap very cold, a lot of well water right now will be very cold. Some of the city water is even very cold. You know, draw it out into a gallon container, let it sit for a day or two, and get it to room temperature and let it off gas a little bit. Of course, collecting rainwater in the summer and so on. But pouring the water through adequately with a bark-based mix is really important. It allows the roots to soak up the water as it's passing by. The orchid root is kind of like a sponge, so the longer the water is passing by it, the more water it's going to absorb. And it's very important to flush out any of the old nutrients and bring in new oxygenation and so on. So that's really the best way to water with a bark-based mix. Now, a lot of the orchids nowadays, the Phalaenopsis, they're again marketed in the sphagnum moss. That's how they're imported. Most of the growers won't change it. They'll just sell it the way it came in. That's a little different animal. That's a real spongy type of mix, and it will stay wet for 2 to 3 weeks at a time. It's very little water needs. You water it maybe with a half a cup of water for a typical 4.5-inch pot, and that'll keep it going for, you know, again, 2 to 3 weeks in some cases. It is somewhat important, though, to water it enough that you have water coming out the bottom of the pot. And that, again, you know, flushes out some of the old stale nutrients, brings in new, especially when you're fertilizing. And to her question about cutting the flower stems off, Phalaenopsis do have a propensity of flowering 2 times a year. So when you have the initial flower spike going and it's starting to expire, you know, right before the last flower is expiring, cut that stem off about 2/3 of the way up from the base of the plant. You'll see these nodes on the stem, and usually you want to count and look at the nodes and count up, you know, 3 or 4 nodes high and cut 1 inch above that 3rd or 4th node with a nice sharp blade or a nice sharp knife. You don't want to use a dull squashing type of tool. Sometimes it damages the stem and it dies back, but they'll reflower off of that old stem a good 80% of the time. Another good source for cultural information is the Orchid Guild's website, orchidguild.org. Between one of the members and myself, we have just updated the care instruction sheets that we used at Orchids by the Acres for a number of years, and they have them now posted on the Orchid Guild's website. It's very, very well written. I had one of the members help me do some editing. I had the information. She helped me provide it in a easy written form for repotting. Everything is on there. Highly recommend to check that and read that thoroughly. And it's printable. We have Phalaenopsis, Cymbidium, Cattleya, Paphiopedilum, Phragmopedium posted on there already. We're going to start posting some of the other genera as soon as I finish writing them, but they're updated with the most current and pertinent information as far as, you know, the orchid growing right now at this date. So I'd highly recommend checking that out.
The Wisconsin Orchid Guild? Orchid Growers Guild?
Yeah, it's the Orchid Growers Guild, and I think their website is orchidguild.org.
Orchidguild.org. Chuck Aker, our guest today. He breeds Phragmopedium orchids and produces new hybrids and sells them to large operations and sometimes to people like you and me. Our guest on Garden Talk, I'm Larry Mueller. We're talking about orchids on Garden Talk today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Our guest is Chuck Aker, breeder of Phragmopedium orchids, and produces new hybrids for sale to commercial growers as well as home hobbyists. His business is called Flasks by Chuck. So, do you grow orchids? What varieties do you like? What questions do you have about keeping them healthy? I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send us an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Well, Chuck, a listener emailed to ask if there's such a thing as an orchid for a beginner, and are the orchids from the grocery store okay?
Yeah, there's definitely an orchid for the beginner. We always recommended the Phalaenopsis orchid for that, and like I mentioned before, pretty much any grocery store is carrying in those now. One thing I do want to advise is you won't often get the plant adequately wrapped up for walking to your car during the winter time. So, you know, like greenhouses and garden centers were very, very avid plant packers and wrappers to make sure the customers can get the things out to their car without any cold damage. So just be aware of that. One thing I do want to recommend is when you're shopping for an orchid at a big box store or wherever, if you're going to choose the Phalaenopsis, try to choose one that is in the beginning of its blooming cycle, where it has maybe, you know, one, two, three flowers open and you can see a number of buds yet still on the stem. That way you get the full longevity of its bloom cycle, which is typically 2 to 4 months from start to finish. When you buy one, sometimes it's all fully bloomed out in, you know, the grocery stores and so on. You know, you may only get a couple of weeks, if that, out of the flowering cycle. But nevertheless, they offer a lot of bang for their buck. They're probably one of the most successfully and reliably reflowered orchids in the average home environment. And with their blooming longevity of 2 to 4 months, in some cases even twice a year, there's very few orchids that will rival that. There are some lady slipper orchids, the Paphiopedilum, which is also a fairly easy houseplant of the orchid family to grow. It's similar in culture to the Phalaenopsis, but doesn't usually offer you that, you know, beautiful array of the pastel colors, you know, the pinks, the purples, and so on. They're a little bit more, in some cases, more muted colors, if that's the right word, but you know, they're attractive plants when they're not flowering. They have a little different foliage structure. So between Phalaenopsis and Paphiopedilum, they're two of the most commonly grown orchids for the beginner in the home, for sure.
Let's take a call. Diane in Milwaukee, thank you for calling. What can we do for you?
Yes, good morning, Larry. Great show. I used to raise orchids for many years. This is 25 years ago. And I went down to Hauserman's, which is a wonderful place, and picked a cymbidium for the first time, which did extremely well in the cooler temperatures. And it had a first-class certificate. And I was wondering exactly what does an orchid need to have a first-class certificate? What is that?
Well, that is a really, really great question. Well, the first-class certificate, commonly known in us orchid world people as the FCC, it is the highest flower award that the American Orchid Society gives in their judging criteria. There are several different levels of these awards given. First of all, you would start out with the HCC, the Highly Commended Certificate, which is basically the entry-level award, and that has a certain parameter of points that is given to that particular orchid flower. The next level up from that is the what we call the AM, which is the Award of Merit, and that is another set of points higher than the HCC, so it gets, you know, the higher quality shape and color and presentation and texture and so on. There's so many different things that the judges do look at to grant these awards. And then finally you get to the FCC, the first class certificate, which is the highest flower award you can get. And it's quite esteemed. It's prestigious. If you developed an orchid through your hybridizing program and, you know, raised it up from seed and showed one and you got an FCC, you're somebody. You know, that's it's really, you know, the pinnacle. And there are all kinds of other awards given by the American Orchid Society, too. And if you wanted to poke around and learn more about that, you can go to their website, AOS.com or AOS.org. I don't know exactly what it is right offhand, but if you just Google American Orchid Society, and they have quite a list of things there. There's plant awards where they'll award the quality of the plant growing. They'll award the consistency of a group of seedlings. They'll award things like the cultural merits or cultural excellence. It's really a very interesting array of awards that they give, and these judges, they study this for years. It's about like being a doctor. You go through the program for, I believe, up to 8 years before you're an accredited American Orchid Society judge.
Wow.
It is very extensive and very interesting. And when we have our orchid show here in Madison, which, again, was canceled this year, unfortunately, but it's really fun to walk around and listen when you can get the chance to do so, which isn't always the case for the general public, but to follow these people around, men and women of all walks of life, and they will be so knowledgeable in one particular genera of orchids, or maybe a group of them judging, you know, Phalaenopsis exclusively or Paphiopedilum exclusively, and they know the histories, they know all the other plants that were awarded from that particular grex or that particular cross, so they know what you know they're up against. Their databases are incredibly complex. When you get an award like that, you get it photographed, it gets put into an archive. They used to have a very nice printed version of that. I don't know if Awards Quarterly is still printed or not, but it's
pretty cool.
Really, really, really cool indeed. And the FCC, the highest award you can get.
Diane, thank you so much. That was a great question. Marcus in Milwaukee, we'll go to you now. Hi, Marcus.
Hi. So I think not just the prettiest orchid, but the prettiest flower I think I've ever seen, I would have to say, is the Dendrobium orchid native to Hawaii. I mean, I feel like if you could take a peacock and make it into a flower, I think it'd be a Dendrobium orchid.
I think, yeah, do they call that one the Hona Hona orchid? It's ringing a bell, but there's some great things for sure. The Dendrobium is an incredibly large genera of orchids. I believe there's up to 1,000 species alone in that genera of orchids. And that doesn't even include the hybrids that were made between those species. So it is a really large, large orchid family.
Thanks a lot for that comment. Appreciate it. Barb in Middleton emailed to ask why orchids are potted in containers without drainage. It makes them nearly impossible to water.
Yikes. Yeah, that's definitely a no-no. And that's, again, somebody cutting some corners there. You know, when you see some of these plants at the big box stores and the grocery stores, of course, they're in a decorative container often. It's a ceramic outer pot. And 9 times out of 10, it does not have a drain hole. But the orchid plant itself is actually in some other type of pot that's set inside this decorative pot. So it is important that you realize that to lift that potted orchid out of that decorative container to do your watering and make sure that it's drained and dripped out freely before you set it back in there. One of the biggest mistakes that we've seen through the years, and we still do, is letting your orchid plant, your orchid pot, sit in water. That is a sure way of producing root rot in a very, very short time. There's a handful of orchids that'll tolerate that, and one of them is what I specialize in, is the Phragmopedium. And due to the fact that it's a terrestrially growing orchid in nature, a lot of the Phragmopediums like access to water pretty much constantly. So on our care sheets for the Phragmopedium, we actually do recommend to let them sit in a shallow saucer of water and let it consume that water until it's gone and then re-add fresh. But that's very uncommon for that. Most of the orchids want to have a free-draining, fast-draining, porous type of mix. Again, most of them are epiphytes in nature. If they sit in water or stay wet too long, that's going to doom their roots. And when the roots are doomed, the plants are definitely in peril.
We have Annette with a question. Is it possible for orchids to get too much light? Her orchids get more direct sun in the winter than they do in the summer.
Yeah. Again, back initially speaking on that, here in Wisconsin or the upper latitudes, you get a lot of light coming in a south window, and it can be damaging in some cases. And what really damages is the heat that the light is creating. So if the air movement is very still across those leaves, where that temperature of those leaf cells can rise up to the point where they're going to collapse, that's really the key. With a little bit more air moving across the leaves, that temperature won't get that high to damage those leaves, and you can grow these plants in this incredibly bright window, and that's where you really get the best results. And there's a little bit of a fine line there. Even if you backed the plant up a little bit from that window, you would be amazed on the temperature difference that light would create on the surface of that leaf, or change the angle of the plant orientated towards the light source. So maybe it's, the leaf isn't, at a 90 degree or 45 degree or whatever that it may be, to that light source coming in to create that excess heat. So that's really the key there. But again, giving your orchids as much light short of damaging or sunburning is really the key of having good culture in our climate here in Wisconsin. So you kind of got to move them around. Sometimes you get too much light sometimes of the year in the south, and just move it off to the side where it's a bright but indirect light source. And that's probably as good as your east or west window for the rest of the year. And so yeah, you play around with it a little bit.
Eleanor, as her Phalaenopsis is about 4 years old, has had lots of blooming over those years, but its most recent flower stalk has grown about a foot, and now the tip's curling over and doesn't seem to be developing further. So, any ideas on that? She's moved it. It gets bright indirect light.
Well, they do have a tendency to follow the light. So her comment of it, growing up and starting to bend over, they're phototropic. They're definitely going to follow the light. She might be a little impatient there, maybe. I don't know. I wouldn't recommend moving it around too much as they're developing their flower spikes like that, because due to the fact that they are phototropic, if you happen to move the plant to a different light source or it's coming from a different angle, that flower spike is going to turn towards that angle if it's not already facing that. So you're going to end up with a curly Q kind of flower stem going there. And the other thing about moving those plants, you know, it's sometimes that they're sensitive to the different room, whether the temperature has been dramatically different or there's a draft on it or something. You know, it's just kind of best to let them sit, you know, and if she doesn't see anything changing after, you know, a month or so, there's a very rare cases where these flower spikes will go to a certain point and just all of a sudden basically expire or terminate there and they won't ever bloom. And if that's the case, I would recommend just cutting it off completely at the base of the stem down by the plant and force that plant to generate another flower spike, because it will. They will make that flower spike. They have a kind of a need, if you would, to flower. So we used to actually go through the greenhouse and cut off flower spikes before they started setting their buds just to stage the plant to bloom at a different time. So we had, you know, a more diverse period of selling orchids in flower. So they definitely can, you know, make their flower spike again after being, you know, cut off like that.
Carol emailed to ask how she should fertilize her orchid. It's in bark. She didn't say what kind of orchid.
Yeah, that's a great question. Mm-hmm. Fertilizing in bark is very important versus fertilizing in sphagnum moss. And the reason is bark is denitrifying in nature in itself, just being there in the pot as it's decomposing. It's breaking down the nitrogen itself, plus the plant wants it. So orchids that are growing in any type of a bark-based mix typically would require fertilization on every second or third watering at the least, because, you know, every time you water, you're flushing out in bark-based mixes. You'll notice that the water goes through those pots rapidly. So you want to replenish that. We used to recommend to fertilize every third watering. So you would water, fertilize, and then just repeat. And to mix it up, you want to have your fertilizer mixed up in bark. You want to have like a nitrogen level of about 20%. So a fertilizer of 20-20-20 formula is probably one of the most common. Mixing it up ahead of time in a gallon container, typically it's a teaspoon per gallon for most of the fertilizer types of that nitrogen level, 20%. Get it diluted well, you know, let it sit for a day or so where it's adequately diluted and room temperature, and then pour that through the pot. I wouldn't recommend catching it. I mean, fertilizer is cheap. If you want to catch it and use it on your outdoor plants or something else, that's great. I wouldn't recommend catching it and reusing it on your orchid again or other orchids, because you can spread some diseases that you may or may not have in your root zone that, you know, that you may not be aware of. But that's basically, again, on our care sheets posted on, and I think I was erroneous when I said the Orchid Guild's website before, Larry. I think it is orchidgrowersguild.org.
Okay.
Those care sheets we have posted there have really great information on fertilizing both in sphagnum moss and in bark.
You know, somebody earlier, a caller earlier, mentioned that her neighbor had recommended using ice cubes for watering. What do you think about that ice cube method?
Yeah, that's, you know, a company developed that back in, I think it was the 90s. They actually marketed it as the ice cube orchid. And I can never forget one of my one of our orchid growing friends down in Dundee, Illinois. He started an orchid business about the same time my father and mother did, and he was German. And you should have heard him when he, you know, there are no ice cubes in nature, and it was just, I'll never forget that. And he's right, you know, it's just one of those marketing things where it allows people to have a total no-braining way of watering. If you use that amount of water on the plant, that's going to be what that particular pot size, that particular plant type, and everything with it is accustomed to, and it works. I'm not saying it doesn't work. It works great. So it really takes the guesswork out of when and how much. But I'm kind of with the old German guy there. That cold water can't be good for them, but you know, it works. So I don't recommend it, and I never will.
You know what? It might surprise some people that vanilla comes from orchids. Tell us about that. What's that orchid?
That is really something. You know, we kind of take that for granted. Back when we were open, we grew several different species of vanilla orchids, and they are just a wonderful plant to grow in the home. They're a vining type of orchid. If you want to see one, go to Olbrich Gardens Conservatory. They've got a vanilla in there climbing up one of the trees, some 20 feet or so. They're just really interesting plants. The flowers are fairly obscure, usually chartreuse green for the most part of the species, short-lived, somewhat fragrant, but yeah, a lot of people don't realize that's where the vanilla flavoring comes from, and it's a very laborious process between growing the plant, getting it big enough to flower, and then pollinating that orchid, because when the vanilla flower actually blooms, it opens up overnight, and when it's open in the morning, you've got to get it pollinated to set the fruit to get the bean. Because by the end of the day, that flower has expired. And your time for getting it to pollinate and set fruit is done. So it's a very, very laborious process. And you can see that doesn't even include the maturation period of the pod, of the fruit, or the curing process of the fruit. Our own Ken Cameron here in Madison, who is the director of the Wisconsin State Herbarium, has written a beautiful book on the history, the natural history and cultivation of vanilla orchids. I highly recommend it. It is a beautifully written pictures, information on the culture of vanilla all over the world, the species that are most involved in, you know, being used for the fragrances and for the tastes and so on, because they're all different. It is really, really a great book. I think he did this back in, I can't even remember when he did it, but I'd highly recommend it. It's just a fun, fun read.
Well, it sounds to me like it would be a fun, fun read, and it's certainly been a fun, fun time to have you back with us, Chuck. It's been so long, and it was just so great to hear your voice again, and you know so much about these orchids. I really appreciate you taking the time to be with us today, and I hope we can do it again sooner than later. Thank you so much.
Well, you're welcome, Larry. I look forward to it.
Chuck Aker, a breeder of Phragmopedium orchids, and produces new hybrids as well. His site, you can go online to flasksbychuck.com. And those Phragmopedium orchids are beautiful. And it's very much fun to have him talk with us about orchids in general and a little bit about those Phragmopediums as well. So thanks to Chuck. We'll talk about new ways to turn dairy waste into useful products on our Monday show at 11. Then at 11:45, the weather guys are back to talk about winter weather statistics. That's Monday on the Ideas Network. But hey, stay with us. Lots in store right through the afternoon. I'm Larry Mueller.